Hi, and welcome to Guideposts. I'm your volunteer reader, Sandy Summers. Today, we will continue reading the October-November 2024 issue of Guideposts with articles like Lucky Chuck. Mysterious Ways, More Than Coincidence. My husband John and I were in the supermarket checkout line when storm warnings began flashing on our phones. We rushed to the car and stuffed the groceries inside just as the rain started to pour. On the drive home, we spotted something ominous in the distance. It looked like a white sheet was hanging low on the horizon, ringed by black clouds. I backed into the driveway. We'd have to make a dash for it. "I'll take the fish inside first and put it in the fridge," John said. "I'll get the rest of..." Before I could finish the sentence, an inner voice interrupted me, a voice I'd come to know as the Holy Spirit. "Wait," it said firmly. The car was just steps from our house. Still, I grabbed John's arm to stop him from opening his door. We both froze. The strange white sheet bore down on us. Howling winds rocked the car. A total whiteout enveloped us. Crash, bang, objects battered the car and slammed into the ground. It all happened so fast there wasn't time to be afraid. The whiteout passed, but then we heard it, a crackling, not 10 feet from the car. A 4-foot-high ball of fire raged. Our electric lines had snapped. One wire draped across the car, its end flaming into the soaked ground. A second wire smoldered in the bush beside the house. Our trees lay splintered like matchsticks. Branches, the garbage can, the mailbox littered the ground around us. I spotted our son, Calvin, stepping out of the house. I cracked open the car door and shouted, "Wait, go back inside." We risked being electrocuted if any of us stepped onto the soaked front yard. John dialed 911. Firefighters came but stayed in the road. Even in their rubber boots, they didn't dare step on our lawn or driveway. Finally, the electric company truck pulled up and the workers shut off the electricity. It took the crew an hour to clear the poles and branches to get to us. We learned that we'd been in the direct path of straight-lined winds, a phenomenon that matches the speed and destructive power of a tornado, but without the rotation. Yet that familiar voice had reached us before the danger did. Catherine Jacobs, Horseheads, New York. Have your own Mysterious Ways story? Send it to mw@guideposts.org. Overcoming Grief. The patient in trauma room 6 looked up at me, smiled, and said, "What's the difference between God and a brain surgeon?" Lucky Chuck, by W. Lee Warren, MD, North Platte, Nebraska. Rushing through the hospital, I grabbed my next patient's chart. Male, early 60s, possible head injury. He flipped his ATV while working cattle on his ranch. I looked at the man's brain scan images. My heart sank. I'm a neurosurgeon. 3 weeks earlier, I'd started a new job at the Wyoming Medical Center in the city of Casper. I was still getting my bearings, but I had no doubt what that gray and white mass in the man's brain images meant. It had nothing to do with his accident. This man had a lethal form of cancer called glioblastoma. He would likely be dead before the end of the year. I glanced at the man's name, Charles Hobson. I could already hear myself, "Mr. Hobson, I'm afraid I have some difficult news." He was in trauma room 6. I knocked and opened a sliding glass door separating his bed from the rest of the ER. To my surprise, Mr. Hobson was already out of bed and back in his denim overalls. He sat pulling on a pair of cowboy boots. "Hello, Mr. Hobson," I said. "I'm Dr. Lee Warren. I'm a neurosurgeon." Mr. Hobson looked up and grinned. He was a large man, built like a college linebacker. "Hey, I got a joke about that," he said. "What's the difference between God and a brain surgeon?" "I have no idea," I said, trying to muster a smile. Mr. Hobson's grin widened. "God don't think he's a brain surgeon." He guffawed and extended a hand. "Name's Charles. Everybody calls me Lucky Chuck." I considered how best to deliver my diagnosis to a man with that nickname, but Lucky Chuck was not done. "I'm an educated man myself," he said, "college degree in animal science. Been a rancher all my life. Believe it or not, I've been struck by lightning 3 times. Between you and me, luck had nothing to do with me sitting here today. It was all by the grace of God." I took a deep breath. Discussing terminal diagnosis with patients is never easy. I hated to shatter this man's happy-go-lucky faith. I knew how it felt to realize God isn't as good as you thought he was. Realism is hard, but necessary. I'd learned that the hard way. I showed Mr. Hobson his brain scan images and as gently as I could told him what they meant. Usually it's at this point that patients become either angry or despondent. Mr. Hobson's smile dimmed a bit, but did not vanish. He grew thoughtful. Maybe this isn't such bad news, he said at last. If the good Lord wants to take me now, so be it. And I'll tell you something, doctor. I've been wanting to see my wife, Wanda, ever since she died of cancer a few years ago, and we lost a baby when we were young. His smile widened again. You know something? I lost God when that baby died, but I found him again. I'll be mighty glad to meet him face to face and see Wanda and our daughter. You lost God, I said. He nodded. And you found him? Another nod. Please, Mr. Hobson, I said, my normal professional demeanor slipping. Tell me more. My wife, Lisa, and I were basically running away when we moved to Wyoming. We couldn't bear to stay in Alabama any longer. 2 years before we moved, our beloved son, Mitch, had been stabbed to death in a random crime the police never solved. He was 19. My world shattered, and not for the first time. I'd enlisted in the Air Force to pay for medical school. During a combat medic tour in Iraq, I was almost blown up in a mortar attack. I saw the worst that war can do to young people's bodies and souls. My own soul never really recovered. My first marriage ended when I returned home and I battled PTSD. I remarried, raised a blended family, and tried to patch up what remained of my faith. Then Mitch died. How could a good God allow something like that to happen? The question tormented me. The platitudes I got from well-meaning people only made things worse. Work was no refuge. Many brain conditions, especially cancer, are difficult to cure. My job frequently involved giving patients and their families bad news. Their raw despair joined mine as a dark shadow in my soul. I seriously doubted God existed. If he did, I was convinced he didn't care about people like my patients or me. Mr. Hobson's thoughtful expression returned. When Wanda's doctor told us about her cancer, Wanda said we needed to decide right then what we believed about God, he said. She said we couldn't wait for the outcome to see if we trusted him or not. We just had to trust. And don't you go being all mad at God when I'm in heaven, she said to me, because that's when you'll need him most. Mr. Hobson grinned again. As usual, she was right. I did need him. And you know something? I found him. You can't look at a prairie sunset or listen to the wind in the tall grass and not know that God is right there beside you. Doctors aren't supposed to let their personal lives intrude on professional decisions. I had to stifle an urge to share my struggles with Lucky Chuck. Instead, I outlined his treatment options. None would extend his life by more than a few months. He cut me off. I'll save you time, he said. I'm not interested in any of that. I saw what chemotherapy did to Wanda, and she died anyway. God's timing is his business, and I don't need to mess with it. Thank you for being honest with me, doctor. Unless there's something else, I should be getting back to my cattle. We shook hands, and I left him to finish getting dressed. The rest of the day, I couldn't stop thinking about Lucky Chuck. He was so different from my other patients. He showed no sign of fear or despair. He simply accepted his diagnosis and looked for what was positive, the prospect of seeing his wife and daughter again. Though I'd grown up a person of faith, I had to admit I was nothing like Lucky Chuck. I kept thinking about what his wife Wanda had told him. We can't wait for the outcome to decide whether we trust God or not. Wanda was not a doctor, let alone a neurosurgeon. Yet, she knew something about brain science I'd forgotten. One of the first things you learn about the brain in medical school is that it changes throughout a person's lifetime. It responds to stimulus. It rewires itself depending on how you use it. That's how you learn a foreign language. You practice grammar and memorize vocabulary until new neural pathways are established that enable you to speak fluently. Wanda was insightful enough to know that faith works the same way. It's not a feeling or an intellectual assent to certain ideas about God. It doesn't depend on miracles or good outcomes. It's more like a skill you build over a lifetime. Wanda and Chuck chose to trust. Over and over, no matter what happened, they trusted God and kept seeking him. Their habit of trust became the foundation of an abiding and unshakable faith. When Wanda died, Chuck kept trusting, even though God seemed absent and despair loomed. He felt his way forward until neural pathways were restored and God reemerged in the sunset and the wind. I hadn't found God because I stopped looking. I abandoned trust and insisted that bad outcomes disproved everything I ever believed. Lucky Chuck offered a better way, a more scientific way. To rise out of despair, I had to learn the language of trust all over again and practice it diligently. I saw Lucky Chuck one more time. Lisa and I ran into him in the Sam's Club parking lot about 2 months after I'd met him in the ER. "Howdy, doctor," he said. I introduced him to Lisa. "Your husband's probably mad at me," he said to Lisa with a grin. "I have cancer and I won't let him operate on me. I figured I'm going to die anyway, so I might as well take the escalator instead of the stairs." He laughed, and Lisa and I couldn't help joining in. "Wanda and Jesus taught me you can be positive or negative about your situation in life," he continued. "They both take the same amount of work, so I just decided I'm going to be hopeful. Makes things feel easier, even when they're hard." We talked some more, then said our goodbyes. 6 months later, I learned that Lucky Chuck had died peacefully. Imagining his joyous reunion with his wife and daughter helped me imagine my own reunion with Mitch one day. For now, I practice my faith. I perform what I call thought biopsies. Whenever I feel despair coming on, I corral my negative thoughts and offer them to God. Like scripture says, if you take your thoughts captive and let God go to work on them, he will transform you by renewing your mind. Lucky Chuck began that transformation in me. He was the real doctor in Trauma Room 6 that day we met. He offered a cure grounded in science, yet beyond anything science can comprehend. I hope in the midst of his joyous reunions, he knows how much he meant to me. For more on this story, see Family Room. A preview from Walking in Grace 2025. But ask the animals, and they will teach you, or the birds in the sky, and they will tell you. Job 12:7. My alarm didn't go off. I woke up late, and that meant the rest of the house woke up late, too. My son, Henry, rushed to eat his breakfast and got dressed while I scrambled to throw together his lunch. Thankfully, he made it out the front door and caught the bus with seconds to spare. Still, that anxious, hurried feeling stayed with me, ruining the comfort of my routine and leaving me with the restless sense that something was amiss. I put on my coat and shoes and grabbed the leash to walk my dog, Soda, and hopefully find some peace. The sun rose over the mountains, filling the sky with gentle hues of pink and purple. Over our neighbor's field, a wedge of geese flew over the tree line. Their honks of encouragement punctuated the morning quiet as they glided gloriously as if in a movie. How do they manage to all get together on time, I thought. Is there a lead mother goose that orchestrates their travels and rallies the flock from place to place? I was on to another thought when a smaller flock of 5 geese loudly honked, flying to catch up in an unorganized jumble. I laughed and shook my head. "I guess your alarm clock didn't go off either," I said to the stragglers, and just like that, my anxiety disappeared, and everything was right once again. Lord, creator of the universe and everything good, help me remember to trust your perfect timing, even on days when I oversleep. Sabra Ciccanelli. Walking in Grace is our most popular devotional book. To order the 2025 edition, visit guidepost.org/WIG. Write to Guidepost P.O. Box 5815, Harlan, Iowa, IA, 51593-1315, or call 800-932-2145. It is available in a hardcover edition for $16.95 or a softcover large print edition for $17.95, plus shipping and processing. I'm Sandy Summers, and you're listening to Guideposts on Sun Sounds of Arizona, a 24-hour reading and information service for people who can't read print due to a disability. If you missed any part of this program, you may access it anytime, on demand, at www.sunsounds.org. In addition to the bi-monthly Guideposts magazine, each week we may be reading some of Guideposts' other daily devotions or inspiring stories from Guideposts online. Faith in Living, His Own Path, My son Tim was a lot like me, and maybe that's why I worried about him, by Rick Hamlin, contributing editor. The email from our son Tim came that November. He'd graduated from college and spent the following year living with us and taking care of kids by being a manny, as he termed it. Then he took everything he'd earned and traveled around the world on the cheap. He'd been on the road since June with a few buddies, sending us the occasional email. I was worried about Tim. He was a talented kid, smart, thoughtful, kind, but he seemed a little aimless. What was he going to do with his life once his wanderlust wore off? I didn't really want to compare him to his older brother, Will, the econ major who got a job working for a big consulting firm right out of college. Will was launched, but for Tim, the history major, it was hard to know what shape his life would take. He was musical like me and had done some theater in college, also like me. I'd gone to Italy where I studied voice for 2 years, earning a living by teaching English before working as an actor and singer in both New York and Los Angeles. I certainly wasn't in anything anybody's ever seen, but I had been focused, hadn't I? Well, at least I thought so. By the time I gave up the acting bug and decided to become a writer and got that starting job at Guidepost, I knew what I wanted to do with my life. I was launched. Would Tim ever be? He was good with kids, but he never talked about becoming a teacher. He played the guitar and had sung in a rock band, but then again, it wasn't anything he seriously pursued. He'd been focused enough on this trip, determined even, traveling through Europe, North Africa, the Middle East. Nothing to worry us too much. He didn't mention his trip through the Sinai Peninsula. Then came his email from India. "Dad, lots of American kids come here and stay at an ashram for a while," he wrote about his fellow travelers exploring Hinduism. "If I did that, I'd rather find a place that's connected to the faith I grew up with. Is there something like that at home?" Wow, Tim hadn't shown any sort of religious bent in college, but then he'd always been a spiritual kid. My wife Carol used to call him the pious tot, the way he'd clutch his hands together in prayer in church, kneeling on the pew cushions. He'd been baptized at the Episcopal Church where we worshiped. He'd been confirmed there, gone to Sunday school, and performed in many Christmas pageants. He sang in the children's choir. When I took him to school in the morning, thumbing through my pocket Bible on the subway, he'd often ask to see his favorite verse. "You know, Dad, the one about Alpha and Omega." We'd turn to the book of Revelation, and he would read it aloud. "I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last letters of the Greek alphabet." Was this email the beginning of something new? I emailed him back, telling him about an Episcopal monastery of Benedictine brothers up along the Hudson River. "Maybe you could visit," I wrote. I'd been there on a church retreat and enjoyed worshiping with them. Later that month, Tim returned from his travels, his hair long, his beard scruffy. He looked so unkempt that Carol made him take off his clothes in our foyer. She took the clothes and everything in his bag down to the laundry room while Tim took a shower. That night at dinner, we heard about his travels. Maybe that was when we learned about the trip through the Sinai. Thanksgiving and Christmas came and went. I wondered when he'd reach out to the Holy Cross Brothers, worried that this was something else he wouldn't pursue. Then in January, he emailed them and visited for a couple days. "I'd like to stay for a while," he told them. They invited him back. He could worship with them, pray the offices 5 times a day, read scripture, seek their counsel, help in the kitchen and garden. Oh, those good brothers. Tim spent 8 weeks at the monastery, then took the bus home. This time he didn't need to leave his clothes at the door. That night at dinner, he had an astounding announcement. "I think I'd like to become an Episcopal priest." "That's wonderful," Carol and I said at the same time. I was also worried, not that it should surprise you by now. Did Tim understand what a long journey it would be, getting sponsored by a church, supported by a bishop, going through months, years of discernment? It was another long journey, 10 years from the time he made the announcement to the joyous day of his ordination this past January. Tim covered much ground, from his volunteer work at our church's soup kitchen to a 10-month stint in South Africa with the Holy Cross Brothers, living at their monastery, working in their school. He followed the love of his life, Henley, to Los Angeles, where he joined a church that had been founded by Japanese Americans and now offered services in Spanish for the Mexican community. He was sponsored by the LA diocese, but at the insistence of the bishop, had to spend an additional year at another parish. He and his bride Henley moved back to New York so they could attend seminary. They found a place half a block away from us, which proved especially joyous and convenient when they had their son Silas. We grandparents were close by to babysit. Seminary was hard work, but Tim savored it, especially learning Greek. He could now read about the Alpha and Omega without any translation. He spent a summer working for a hospice program and volunteered for 2 years at a parish in the South Bronx, preaching in both English and Spanish. I worried about what kind of job he might find with a 2-year-old and another baby due. Enough with the worries, Dad. By now I should have learned to trust more in my son and in God. Last spring I gave a talk at a church in Connecticut and chatted with the rector about my kids. The older son, Will, in San Francisco was working for Pinterest, and the younger one, Tim, was soon to be ordained in the Episcopal Church. "Have him call me," the rector said, following up with an email. After a slew of interviews, both Tim and Henley, he was offered a position, one that came with not only an apartment for the young family, but also free nursery school. How blessed we are to have them a 45-minute drive away. We're on hand many a Sunday to help out, especially with the arrival of little May. The church has multiple services, including one with all the kids present. More than once, we have heard Tim preach, holding his son in his arms. I wonder if someday he will worry about his son's future the way I worried about his. I've come to believe that this sort of worry is much more about love than a lack of faith. Of course, I trusted my children's to God's loving care, but worry is a form of care too, isn't it? The Pursuit of Happiness, Living an Abundant Life, a conversation with spirituality and health researcher Harold G. Koenig, MD, on what makes people truly happy. Interview by Edward Grinnan, Editor-in-Chief. Are you a happy person? It's a question I've been asking people lately. You might think the answer is an easy one, but hold on. There are many shades of happiness and many paths to finding it. Still, happiness appears fundamental to who we are, so much so that we may be hardwired for achieving it, which might be why Thomas Jefferson put it in the Declaration of Independence, fused to life and liberty. Is happiness holy? Beyond my pay grade, I'm afraid. So I asked a wise old friend of Guidepost, Dr. Harold G. Koenig, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences and director of Center for Spirituality, Theology, and Health at Duke University. Edward Grinnan, tell us a little bit about your work. Harold G. Koenig. I've been doing research on spirituality and health for more than 40 years. Seeing how a person's religious beliefs are connected to their mental, social, behavioral, and physical health. Edward, we're here to talk about happiness, so let me ask, are you a happy person? Harold, I think so. Edward, why are you happy? Harold, I'm a Christian, which really informs all aspects of my life and my relationships and my work, so that's really the basis for my happiness. Edward, are we hardwired as human beings to be happy? Harold, we are hardwired to be happy if we're behaving in a manner that's consistent with the rules and laws that God has put into place for humans to achieve an abundant life. There are genetic factors and developmental experiences, exposures we've had as children to people and environments that influence our level of happiness. But everything else being equal, which generally they are not, the person who is more religious is going to be happier. There's more to life than happiness. There's meaning and purpose, a sense of connection with others, physical and mental health. Those things produce a flourishing life. Edward, you mentioned childhood trauma. So many people have trauma. How do you overcome things that can be blockers to happiness? Harold, you need to give them some sort of meaning that will help enhance your well-being. The religious person may be experiencing trauma, but they will abide by the rules and values that they've been taught. They will practice forgiveness. They will practice loving their neighbor. And those things will produce healing. That doesn't mean they will do away with suffering. Even great religious leaders have suffered terribly. Edward, people who are suffering may not be able to see beyond their suffering. Harold, my wife has severe chronic pain. How does she make sense of it? She believes that all things can produce something good for those who love God. We may not understand how and why, but somehow the suffering will lead to something good in the life of the person who is suffering, as well as in the people around them they are influencing. Edward, for some people, the need to influence others positively is a way out of their suffering. How do our mental states influence the people we're around, particularly the people we love? Harold, Jesus said the most important commandment is to love God with all your heart and all your strength, and the second is to love your neighbor. Consequently, when we love other people, when we sacrifice our own needs for them, that produces a sense of meaning, purpose, and happiness in us. Edward, you mentioned forgiveness as a quality that undergirds happiness. What other qualities would you identify in a happy person? Harold, the happy person will be someone who has meaning and purpose in life, someone who cares for others and who wants to do good in the world. Now, there are people who don't do those things who are also happy. I don't think it is a sustained happiness, though. Edward, can a person of no particular religious belief or just sort of a general sense of spirituality be happy? Harold, I just finished writing a book called Spiritual Readiness, a Survival Guide for the Non-Believer. I focused on the behavior of the person. If the person is caring for other people, if they're avoiding selfishness and focusing on doing good in the world, that can produce a great deal of happiness. So yes, I think the non-believer can experience a certain level of happiness. Is it the same level of joy as the religious person? I don't know. Edward, you're not that person, so it is hard to know. What's also come up is the role of gratitude. The happy person seems to start as a grateful person. Harold, to be grateful to others and to express that gratitude produces so much joy. We tend to forget just how grateful we ought to be, given what we have. Here in the United States, we have so much we just take for granted. Thinking about how much one can be grateful for is a way to produce joy and happiness. Edward, how do we slow down the blur of everyday life and think about those things that we take for granted? Harold, my phone goes off every 2 hours to remind me to thank God for all I have. Put little reminders on your computer or the refrigerator or the mirror. I walk every day in nature. Psalm 100 says to shout joyfully to God, all the earth with the blue sky and the sun and the animals, and my own body as part of the earth. Edward, what about technology? It's said that technology isolates us even as it connects us. Isolation is probably the biggest underminer of happiness. Harold, any gift can be used excessively. If you're dependent on technology and avoid people, then you're not going to be all that happy. Email and social media are a great opportunity to communicate, but getting together in person is important. In research we did not long ago, we looked at the effects of attending religious services, either in person or online. We found that only attending religious services in person was related to benefits to mental, physical, and social health. That's all the time we have today for Guideposts. We'll continue reading The Pursuit of Happiness next week. Thank you for listening. My name is Sandy Summers. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.